You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th, hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady, live only on Netflix.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Ladies and gentlemen, it is showtime. Please welcome the team of the Fulhamish Podcast.
It's the Fulhamish Podcast, your independent voice of Fulham FC. My name's Sammy James. Welcome to the show. Today, we're going to be looking ahead to our game at Bramall Lane this weekend against Sheffield United. We'll also be looking back at some of the Fulham players who have been playing international duty over the past couple of weeks. And I have got so many emails. I'll try and get through some of those before the end of the show. And I'm joined by the regular Thursday club today, Jack Collins. Hello.
Hello, Sammy. Good to have you back, mate.
Nice to be back. And Peter Rutzler. Hello.
Hello. Hi, Sammy. Hi, Jack. How are we?
Hello, mate.
I'm very tired today.
Yeah.
Late night for me.
You were at the Wales-Poland game last night.
I was. Actually got to do some international football, which was fun. Big game, very tense. But yeah, it was quite a walk back to the hotel. And then the hotel was nearby, like a nightclub or something. I could hear it. You know, when you can almost feel it through the walls. So I had that. And then the shower didn't have any hot water as well in the morning. It just wasn't very great. All in all, quite difficult, but enjoyed the experience.
And that was not just because they wanted you to go watch Harry Wilson from a Fulham hat. I assume you were also just there covering Wales.
Yeah, Wales hat. Wales hat for that one.
Okay. Yeah. A man of so many hats, The Athletic.
Indeed.
The glamorous life of a football journalist was what I was thinking through that entire story. These are the ones they don't tell you about.
I mean, this is definitely one of the worst experiences, I think, from that side of things, but wasn't too bad.
Obviously, heartbreak in particular from a Fulham perspective for Harry Wilson, who felt like he left everything on that pitch last night.
Yeah, no, he did. And I think the rest of the Wales squad were the same. It was incredibly tense, as you'd expect with these big games at the Cardiff City Stadium with Wales. The atmosphere was fantastic. You could see it in the city before the game. And it was a real excitement. And then as soon as the whistle went, oh my God, the anxiety took over. It was just like woof, like just the air was taken out of the ground. The kind of anxiety where, you know, people go to sing and you start and you just can't carry on because it's a bit too much. And I think the way the game was played, I think both teams were quite cagey. They set up to be safe. Mm. Poland haven't been great. They've got a new coach who's come in for Fernando Sanch. Is that right? I pronounced that right as well, Jack?
Yeah. All good.
There we go. I can't pronounce it. It's Mihail Probrevich.
I can't tell if you're right or wrong on that one.
He's come in and has been 5 unbeaten. Wales have actually picked up a little bit and we're 7 unbeaten and obviously did really well against Finland. A really impressive 4-1 win, which Harry Wilson was at the heart of. I think he was involved in 3 of the goals, wasn't he?
Yeah.
And you thought, okay, well maybe they'll carry that momentum on, and it just didn't quite happen. David Brooks had been unwell, so he couldn't start. Kiefer Moore came in, and Wales were very direct. It was all very functional. It was all a moment to win the game, a set play, that kind of thing. I mean, Ben Davis was about a quarter of a centimetre offside, wasn't he, when he put the ball in the net before half time? And ultimately went to penalties, their first ever shootout, and they lost. And it was, yeah, really brutal, really brutal. I do feel like this team, I know they're moving on from Gareth Bale, and it's a new direction now where you don't have that match winner, and they could have done with a match winner last night. I do feel they could have done a bit better with their qualifying. There's a good team there. They're all playing regularly coming into these playoffs as well, which wasn't what happened before the World Cup, and is why they struggled. But yeah, so I think that's where the frustration will be, because their group had Turkey, Croatia, Latvia and Armenia in qualifying, and they finished third.
Well, it was the games that they didn't win was really, because they actually beat Croatia, and
They lost to Armenia 4-2 in Wales, yeah. I'm pretty sure. And yeah. It was like, are Armenia good, or have Wales just completely lost the plot? And it was sort of the answer was somewhere in the middle, as it usually is. But it was those early games really hurt them. They that first couple of games in qualifying, they just completely fell apart.
But just from a Fulham perspective, obviously Harry Wilson again doing really well, playing in a slightly more central role. He was tasked with getting into white. It was sort of a 3-4-3, isn't it? Just trying to get close to Kiefer Moore. And I think that's what they didn't do particularly well. And we were talking about that before the pod. But he's got quite an important role for his country. And he had one really good moment in the second half where he picked up the ball on the right touchline, had a lovely first touch, just beat his marker before his marker had even actually arrived on the scene. Played a 1-2. Burst into the edge of the box, got absolutely clattered on the edge of the box. And then you just think, oh, is this his moment? Are we going to see a free kick? But we haven't seen the free kicks. We haven't seen them since he's come to Fulham. So maybe that's next on the agenda.
Jack, moving on from Wales, a big international break for our two Americans, in particular, Anthony Robinson, CONCACAF Nations League victors. Three times in a row, a 2-0 victory over Mexico. I know the Americans listening will love me saying that. Another international trophy for Anthony and Tim.
Yeah, and I think that when you look at it, on top of, you know, the trophy and all of those things, and all of those things are important, especially coming into this cycle, I think, with the Copa America and then the World Cup, both at home for the US. The performance against Mexico was so far and away an improvement on what we saw in that first game against Jamaica. Now, obviously, Bobby Reid was playing on the other side of that game, so it's interesting to watch from that perspective. And him starting on the right wing and playing up against Jedi, I thought was intriguing. But the whole performance from the US in that first game was a shambles. And they were incredibly lucky to make the final. They took their moment of opportunity, and they were the better side in extra time, fine. But Jamaica would have been gutted not to have held out. And having been, I think, generally the better team throughout that game, this was the complete opposite. And the US stepping up into this role and stepping up into, you know, what is their big derby game, the game they know as 2-0, as you say, to kind of put in a performance like this, I thought was very impressive, and a much bigger step in the right direction ahead of what is a big summer for the US in this Copa. I don't think anyone is saying they're amongst the three favourites to win it, but I think that there is an expectation that minimum get out of the group stages and probably win a knockout game if we're trying to grow into something worth talking about when we get to that World Cup on home soil at that point. So big win for Anthony, big win for Tim. But I just think the performance in the second game would have allayed a bit of the fears around what was going on with the US, especially in the second half.
Yeah, because they played a semi-final against Jamaica, and the US won 3-1. And Jamaica, though, went 1-0 up within the first minute, and then the US equalised in probably the last minute of
last kick of the game.
But it was Bobby who got the assist for that Jamaica opener. Jamaica then won the third place playoff against Panama, I believe it was. Yep. I mean, Bobby was probably one of the best players in the Jamaica side, because they're in disarray right now. Leon Bailey's not playing because he's been suspended. There was injuries, there were suspensions. I think Bobby Reid might have been one of, if not the most senior player for Jamaica.
Yeah, it felt like it was a big leadership role in that side, and to step up into it. And I thought his performance, he gave everything in that performance against the States. It felt like he left absolutely everything on the park. And look, this isn't something we're not used to with Bobby. He does this regularly for Fulham. He's one of those players that you never start a game and think, well, he's not going to put in 110% at every moment. And it's one of the things we love about Bobby Decord over Reid. But yeah, I thought he must have gone off at that point and been like, I've worked my socks off. I've left everything on the pitch. And then to see them concede in the last kick of the game, as you say, it's probably absolutely gutting. But then, you know, to turn it around and take that bronze medal spot, which is important in itself, and just another step of being like, okay, we are on the way up, especially, as you say, in turbulent times. Felt like a big moment. So shouts out to Bob as well.
Yeah, well done, Bobs. The other kind of moment that really stood out for me, I'm sure there's a couple that might stand out for you, but Marek Rodak saving a penalty from Erling Haaland as Slovakia played Norway. It was a 1-1 draw in Norway, I believe. Heck of a moment for Marek, right? I mean, I've always thought with Erling Haaland, I never forget the penalty he took against us and he scored it, but Bernd Leno got super close. Like, I think Erling Haaland's obviously the best striker in the world, but I've never been actually like 100% convinced by his penalty taking skills. But actually, I put that down to much more of a great save from Marek than necessarily a bad pen from Erling. Similar to the Dan James penalty last night, where I was like, I mean, he's hit it low, hard, and got it in the corner. You've got to give props to the keeper when that's the situation.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's one of those where if the keeper goes the other way, everyone goes good pen. If the keeper goes the right way, people start questioning if it's at a savable height, which is always one of those things that's amused me. I remember talking to Asmir Begovic a couple of years back on ranks and him being like, what's a savable height? What a ridiculous statement. Like, everything's a savable height if you're at that height. It's not a savable height if you can't get to it. So, yeah, it's a good save. He gets across really, really well to it. It was an opportunity, a relatively rare opportunity to start for Slovakia as well, because there's obviously a little bit of competition in there to take that role and who, you know, kind of gets the nod there. So for him to be given that opportunity and to take it by saving a penalty from, as you say, probably the best striker in the world, it's not bad going, is it? Not bad going.
Yeah. Any other international appearances that caught your eye? I thought it was quite interesting, one of them, that João Palhinha was given a rest by Portugal.
Look what happened. So João Palhinha obviously played in the first game and Portugal won very comfortably. They took him out, brought in this fella, I can't remember his name, a bit older fella, Cristiano Ronaldo or something, and lost 2-0 to Slovenia. So yeah, I mean, I'm not saying here that you'd have Palhinha ahead of Ronaldo as that exact point. I know they're obviously different players, but you know, you drop Palhinha, you bring in Ronaldo and you go from a relatively comfortable win to a very uncomfortable loss. Palhinha getting that rest and also just re-establishing himself, being like, by the way, I'm really crucial to this team. Great stuff. And great stuff from a Fulham perspective as well, because one of the things we talked about when Palhinha was linked with Bayern, and obviously more than linked, was about that, making sure that he was in that Euro squad and making sure that he was starting for Portugal in these next couple of years as these big tournaments roll around, getting those opportunities and making sure he's one of the names that can't be left off. He's doing that via performance. And I think that's a good thing for Fulham, because if he's starting in these games and starting in these internationals, he can be like, well, I'm starting, it's okay. If he wasn't, maybe that then becomes an issue. But, you know, talking of loose phones, obviously Andreas Pereira also...
Yes, of course. How could I forget?
Well, it came on at 2-1 down in this game against Spain, and they equalised pretty quickly afterwards. Obviously, did brilliantly for the goal at Wembley against England. And
that goal was Andreas's assist in reality.
Yeah, I mean, Vinicius just puts it away. Then Andreas is on the assist books. And, you know, Luckily for Brazil, Endrick's there to tuck it away. Great moment for him. Another great moment for him last night, scoring at the Bernabeu for the first time. Will not be the last. But yeah, I thought Andreas came on and made a difference as well. He was someone who started to affect the game. And it sort of devolved a little bit into quite a scrappy affair by this point. And you look at the scoreline, 3-3, Brazil, Spain, you'd be like, oh, that was probably quite a good game. It wasn't all that good a game in real terms. But I thought Andreas did enough to show his worth when he came on in both games for Brazil. And that's a nice place to be. I would suggest that based on these two performances, as long as something doesn't go drastically wrong, Andreas has a very good shot being in that Copa America squad.
God, that's amazing. I have this weird prediction that now Andreas, just that I felt like, all season, and particularly in the last few months, it's a confidence thing. I'm so certain of it with Andreas, and that actually if he needed something to give him some confidence, hopefully it would have been a goal for Fulham, but that didn't really come about. And I just, that moment at Wembley, like, yeah, okay, Vinicius got the assist, but really it's Andreas Pereira's assist. And what a feeling that must have been for him. I'm sure the coaching staff will have been like, okay, yeah, Vinicius is the one on the board, but we know that without you, that goal doesn't happen. I just wonder if it's the kind of little bit of swagger that might just help Andreas in these next few games. Just got this weird little feeling, weird little hunch. I've had a couple of good hunches this year.
Yes, you have.
That we might be at the start of an Andreas Pereira little run of form. Few goals, few assists.
The Pereira-sance. I'm trying to find it.
Is the Andreas-sance?
Yeah, that's better. Well done. Yeah, that's good. Okay. Yeah, very good. That's excellent. Yeah, I don't mind it. It's a shout. I think it's an interesting one.
He needed something, a shot of something, someone to be like, and I don't know if it was easily going to come at club level. I just wonder if it might be one of those where he returns to Motspur Park just with a stride in his step. Yeah, I just represented Brazil twice and did pretty well. Like, he's going to be top of the world.
Yeah.
And I think he probably needed that boost. Any other internationals before I move on? Anything else that caught your eye?
Sasha played 45 minutes for the second game running, which is nice. Just getting minutes in the tank, being part of that Serbia squad, but not necessarily. They were okay. They beat Cyprus 1-0. It wasn't anything to write home about. I watched Kevin and Babu come on for Switzerland last night as they beat Ireland 1-0, which was deeply uncomfortable. He didn't do anything of particular note, but it was weird seeing him come on. And I saw that Jay played in the England under 21s game against Luxembourg. He didn't score in a 7-0 win, which is, I imagine, slightly disappointing in some ways, but a good win. England are second in the under 21 qualifying group. There's a really good battle going on at the top of that little league. So yeah, nice for Jay to get minutes as well and keep moving up the ranks in the England pack.
Before we move on to looking ahead to Sheffield United, one bit of news that dropped today as we're recording on Wednesday. Fulham did a kind of press release for the new Riverside stand. They unveiled their latest plans. Lots of different restaurants and bars that you can potentially use if you want to go watch Fulham and have a massive great hole in your wallet. You've got the Gourmet, the Original, the Brasserie. Peter, which one of those took your fancy?
Oh yeah, I've been having a look through these.
The Sky Deck. You're a Sky Deck man, aren't you? I mean, can tell.
If there was ever a time or reality or parallel universe where I could go and afford it, it would probably be... You'd probably have to do the sports bar one, but I don't feel like I've
is that not just
vibes.
Under the stand?
Yeah,
is that not just the normal bit?
It's like level minus one. I think they've tried to go for that. Well, like you see in like big towns and cities, like that kind of sport. I reckon that they're hoping that when there's not games on, that people are going to come there and watch.
Brentford have one underneath.
Big Premier League matches and you'll have the F1 on one screen, the Premier League in the middle. You'd probably have some sort of like game from the continent on another screen. Wings and hot dogs and all sorts.
Yeah, Brentford have one underneath the G-Tech. It's called the Dugout as well, which is interesting. But I do wonder if all of the... But their one is not a paid entry bar. You just go in there after games if you're in the right stand.
Oh, okay.
Which is... That's what I kind of assumed this would be. That no. You could just go in there if you want after games.
It doesn't look like that. I mean, they've not given a huge amount of detail. They did the press release this morning. I think it's had mixed reaction. There was quite a strong article against it all in the Telegraph, and then some other outlets kind of just reported the facts that Fulham have unveiled these latest plans. I thought it quite interesting, Peter, that we all thought this might be ready for next season in August, and pretty much all the plans, barring a couple of the spaces.
The dugout will be all right.
The dugout might be ready, but lots of it is December, and given how it's gone so far, if we hit December, I'll be quite impressed.
Yeah, I mean, it has been delayed three times now, hasn't it? So I think just getting them out there is, I think that will be a result at this stage, particularly when you're financially planning for these things. I mean, to do it in the middle of the season, you're hoping that the season is going well at that point, which would probably help sales. Yeah, I've obviously been in Cardiff, so I've come back and been reading through the packages this morning. it's that balance the whole time, isn't it? I think everyone sort of accepts that Fulham need to diversify their revenue if they can sell these packages and bring in that kind of money. That's great. The flip side is you don't want to be pricing out people who previously sat in the Riverside. And I think also elsewhere in the ground and trying to make sure that you're getting everybody into the ground. I think the Telegraph piece is interesting because I think it reflects sort of a wider move within the game across the Premier League. And we've seen already actually a lot of season ticket prices go up across the board at other clubs. We haven't seen Fulham's numbers yet.
Yeah, there's a reason for
that.
But
where you have these really quite lucrative offerings. I was looking at what other clubs are doing. West Ham have got a helicopter ride. Have you seen that? It's like a package for two, and you get a helicopter ride across London, and then you get some kind of fancy, high flying seat somewhere.
Do you get dropped in from the helicopter? Because I think I'd probably be tempted if you like. Do they land it in the centre circle for you? Etc.
Redo the 2012 Olympics.
Yeah, yeah, I was going to say that's what they did with James Bond and the Queen, didn't they? He dumped out the helicopter into the Olympic Stadium.
Then I might be tempted, but I don't like if you'd have to get out of it. I imagine a relatively like quite a long distance away in the Olympic Park, and then have to walk the last bit anyway. I feel like I could have just gone on the tube.
I mean, for me, I've always kind of maintained I don't really mind what they do with the Riverside. I thought it was interesting, and it looks like it's by design. There's very little Fulham about some of the plans. I thought that we might have the Cohen Bar and the Haynes Bar and the Sean Davis Bar and all of those kind of things, but
Fotheringham Bar.
It was very generic. With the names, the Gourmet, the Brasserie, and all of these things, but even with the name Fulham Pier or the Riverside as they've branded it, they are quite clearly going for this audience that isn't really just trying to market within Fulham fans. Which to me, I think a lot of people think that I always want to bash the club for any reason whatsoever. Seems smart. You might as well advertise and market to a much wider base of clients. And, the packages for these things are, we found out, start at £4,500 rising to £10,000.
Or for one visit?
No, for a season ticket.
Okay.
I think it's lower than that. I think the entry's lower than 4.5.
Okay. We got an email from someone that inquired, and that was what was given to him, but we didn't get all the context. So you could well be right here, Peter. I don't massively mind how they market that. The argument has always been how it impacts the rest of the fan base.
I just would add that there is something to be said about the fact that 13 of every 14 days, or more than that over the course of a year, but during the season, the ground isn't in use.
Yeah.
For Fulham games.
That's always been the model.
So to have something that maybe has more generic symbolism and names and all of that around, and look, these restaurants I don't think are just going to open on match day, right? These restaurants are going to be open all the time. They're going to be trying to build a place where people go for dinner and drinks, etc., which is all fine. It's all fine. I would just suggest that at that point, can you not just kind of rebrand it on match day once a week? All you need to do is just, stick on some Fulham memorabilia or put some things up on the walls. Surely those things aren't too difficult to achieve in order to give it a flavour of the club for its primary purpose.
Which could still happen. I'm sure there'll be some references to Fulham.
I think there's a few to Fulham legends walking around and being in those facilities and stuff like that. And I think we've seen players, they do sort of player interviews down there, I think.
Current Riversiders get access to a place where they generally wheel out Joao Palhinha or Tom Kearney or whoever's around to do a little Q&A, which again, is one of those exclusive little perks that just kind of happens. And I'm not massively anti that. I just wish that, and this is the case at so many clubs where they're squeezing out, getting as much as they can out of the hospitality packages. Great. Go for it. Have a pool, have a bowling alley. I don't really care. It doesn't seem to filter down. One thing that I thought was quite interesting, Peter, was that there was references to these Michelin star chefs. I mean, you do have to have made some food first, I believe, to get a Michelin star. I don't exactly know how the process works.
Hang on, no, but if you're a chef at a different restaurant and you've got a Michelin star.
Well, if you've worked for a place that's got a Michelin, I don't think chefs come with stars. Establishments come with stars, and you might have worked at that restaurant. As far as I know, I'm not an expert.
I wondered if you set up a restaurant and that restaurant got given a Michelin star,
And then you came and curated the menu for something else. Well, you I think could you could sell that as a Michelin. If I got Marco really. Pierre White to curate a menu for me, I would be entitled, I think, to call that a menu from a Michelin star chef.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I was just
I don't think they're going to have Marco Pierre White in there on match days, just so we're clear. But like, I also don't know if Marco Pierre White has a Michelin star. So like, this whole point could be moved. But the point being that, you know, when you're talking about it, I think, yes, I agree with your point, but I thought they'd written, when this came up first, I thought they'd written Michelin star restaurant. I was like, no. And then I read it and I was like, no, that's actually fine. I think this is okay.
I think one of the key things will be, is what's coming next year, which still isn't ready, which is the hotel and the health club, which is where the pool is on that side. Those two things will be key all year round, and then once the walkways open and those facilities, in addition to where those bars are within the ground, in terms of revenue. So once they get started, that'll make quite a noticeable difference as well.
I am mentally preparing myself for everyone that I ever meet that isn't a Fulham fan. Obviously we've had things down the years. First it was the neutral stand. I'm still 10 years after it was gone telling people that there isn't a neutral stand. People still ask me if the Michael Jackson statue's there. I'm sure everyone listening to this has the same problems. I cannot wait for the rest of my life people to ask me about the pool at Craven Cottage.
The new MJ, man.
I really thought it was one of those things, Peter, that was going to be like, yeah, we'd all seen it on the drawings, the initial kind of concept drawings. I really just had this feeling of like, they're not actually going to have an open air infinity pool at Craven Cottage. I mean, how many days a year is this thing's going to get used? Like,
we need the key questions answered, don't we? We need,
is it heated?
Yeah, is it heated?
If it's heated, then more.
Maybe.
People go in heated pools in like Iceland in the middle of winter, man.
I don't think it's going to be that hot. That's from like, that's like from thermal energy.
No. I don't think they found
a geezer below the riverside.
They found a few geezers. They're just not in the riverside stand. I think you made a really good point though earlier on, which was like, this doesn't affect me because I don't sit in the riverside stand, right? It affects the people though who sat in the riverside stand before and were promised, you know, that they were going to be given, you know, it's one thing saying you can have first dibs on the seats when they come back. It's another thing saying, oh yeah, by the way, they've gone up five times.
Well, look, have a look at the plans. They're on the Fulham website. I think there's a lot more questions to be answered here. I don't think tons has been clarified with what's here. I don't think anything was particularly like, I wasn't expecting that. It was interesting to see some drawings and how it's going to look. But, you know, the real proof is going to be in the general admission season ticket prices, which, well, who knows when they come out. Lots of other clubs are announcing theirs. I thought very interesting, just before we finished, that Palace announced a season ticket price freeze last week. So I feel like that puts the cat amongst the pigeons for the club, because I always think that if there's one club that is, so, you know, we sometimes say we're a bit like Brentford, or, well, I like to think we're not like Brentford, but that they're a comparable club. Palace are the real comparable club to Fulham, I always think. So interesting to see that they went down the ticket price freeze. Right, we're going to take a break there. Afterwards, we'll look ahead to Sheffield United on Saturday.
This is an advertisement for BetterHelp, a portal for finding online therapy. How's your social battery right now? If you feel a bit drained or lacking enthusiasm to meet all the social commitments in your life, then that can be a totally normal thing, especially with things picking up as we head out of winter. I know that pretty frequently a weekend just doing a few chores and watching the football was about the limit of my energy resources. But therapy can be a place to help you gain the self-awareness to build a social life that doesn't drain your batteries. Contrary to popular belief, therapy isn't just for those who have experienced major trauma. The overall goal is to empower you to be the best version of yourself. And if therapy is something you've considered, then why not give BetterHelp a try? BetterHelp is entirely online and designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. They'll match you with a UK mental health professional with a wide variety of expertise. There's no referral needed, and you can switch therapists at any time for no additional charge, giving you complete control over the whole experience. Fulhamish listeners get 10% off their first month at betterhelp.com/fulhamish. That's betterhelp.com/fulhamish.
Part two of the Fulhamish podcast. Sammy here on the Thursday Club with Jack Collins and with Peter Rutzler. Thank you to Green King Sport for continuing to sponsor the Thursday Club this season. If you want to watch that big City v Arsenal game on Sunday, go to your local Green King Sport pub. They'll have it on one of their big HD TVs and you'll be able to watch the game there. Plus, if you download the Green King Sport app, you'll be able to get 10% off your drinks during any televised match. Fulham not on the box this Saturday, but we are on the box next Tuesday for the Nottingham Forest game away. It's on TNT Sports, 7:30 kickoff. So again, if you're not hanging up to Nottingham, maybe you haven't got TNT Sports because it's hideously expensive TNT Sports, I'm just going to say it. And so go to your local Green King Sport pub. They'll have it on there and you'll be able to watch Fulham, hopefully, pick up 3 points in Nottingham and get 10% off of your drinks at the same time. Let's look ahead then to Sheffield United on Saturday at Bramall Lane. And I mean, Peter, this feels like a really, I don't know, it's one of those games where you're like, oh God, Fulham's fully expected to win. If we don't, everyone's kind of laughing at us. But at the same time, Sheffield United have that kind of surely free hit mentality now where they're just like, we know we're down. We're probably just going to see if we can win a few football matches and make it a bit competitive. They've had a couple of weeks off to prepare for this. They've probably managed to sit down and be like, come on, lads, this is what we're doing wrong. This is how we can maybe give ourselves a fighting shot of getting back into it. I'm just a bit nervous about this one, but obviously, considering how bad Sheffield United are, we should win comfortably.
Yeah. Fulham should win comfortably. The last trip there was the 4-0 defeat, wasn't it? After winning the title.
All the players were drunk.
Yeah. I was in Molly Malone's in Sheffield the night before that, and the players might as well have been too, because everyone was a state that day.
Yeah, that didn't go very well. I mean, it's always the kind of game. I mean, I guess Burnley is the warning, isn't it? You know, Fulham have given Burnley 4 points this season, taken four off Arsenal and handed them to the Claretts. Yeah, the reverse game was 3-1. I remember it being quite a tricky game.
It was.
Requiring that fluky Tom Kenny goal, the big looping one.
The late goal from Willian as well makes the scoreline look a lot nicer than it actually felt in real terms, I think.
Well, it was a weird one in general, but obviously it was really overshadowed by Chris Basham's injury. Yeah. And then the goal that Sheffield United scored, which I believe was in Robinson's own goal, came about because Diop pulled his hamstring mid-play. And then Sheffield United were like, well, we're not going to knock the ball out. And they were within their rights to do so. And Fulham were completely caught short. So it was a very awkward game for us. I mean, Jack, Sheffield United, I don't know, like, they've been obviously like so bad in some games, but like, I mean, I think all this talk of them being worse than Derby was always wrong. There are some half okay players, but like, clearly the way that they went into this season, like, was they were never going to do well considering the basket case that they had before the season.
Yeah, I mean, also losing two of the key components of last season's side in Illiman and Diaye and Sander Berge obviously was never going to help Sheffield United. And then there was no real, it didn't feel like there was real funds to free up. They've got some good players, as you say, and a couple of players here that I've spoken before about that I would like Fulham to be looking at if Sheffield United, or if and when I think Sheffield United do get relegated. I really like Vinicius Souza in the middle. Very, very busy, very lively, a little bit partial to a yellow card, but we've had, you know, midfielders who speak Portuguese who are partial to a yellow card before who have done well in this Fulham side. And Gustavo Homer is someone that we've talked about on this podcast for a long, long time. And then Cam Archer, who is a really good footballer and has scored some really nice goals this season as well. James McAtee. There's names in here that you look at and think, okay, there's players in there. There just doesn't feel like there's any cohesion. And when they've been opened up, they've been really opened up. And, you know, there was points in that game where they lost, I think, so last game they played, they drew 2-2 with Bournemouth, where they let a 2-goal lead slip, if I'm not mistaken. And before that was the 6-0 loss at home to Arsenal, where Arsenal were 5-0 up after, 20 minutes? And it did feel like they were going to be able to you know, put double figures.
That could have been 15 side. If Arsenal hadn't taken their foot off the gas.
Yeah, it was like watching, at times it was like watching a team who had completely and utterly, I think, not thrown in the towel. I wouldn't describe it as that. It was like just did not have the facilities to deal. And look, this is an incredibly good Arsenal team, so let's not beat around the bush, you know, one that we've taken 4 points off. But when you look at that team and you think, okay, cool, if they can be got at like that, what you've got to do with this Sheffield United side is start fast. If Fulham score early, you can think, okay, can we pile on the misery in many ways? And I don't mean that with any sort of disrespect or any sort of malice. It's just, okay, can we take that opportunity? We've seen that once rattled, they can be got at. Fulham surely have to be looking at that and thinking, yeah, okay, the way to do this is to start really fast, to come out of the blocks like a train and try and put this to bed early doors, because we've seen them collapse and fall apart.
Well, particularly at home as well.
At home. So Brighton, obviously, the Arsenal game.
Villa.
There have been some really bad results.
It's six, their last four home games in all competitions, 6-0 against Arsenal, 5-0 against Brighton, 5-0 against Villa, 5-0 against Brighton, because Brighton did it twice in about 3 weeks in the FA Cup and the league.
I'm just going to quickly look on Skybet to see what the odds are on a Sheffield United 1-0 win. Carry on.
I mean, that's the thing, Peter, isn't it? If Fulham, I think, take an early lead, as Jack mentioned, then I'm quite confident of a nice afternoon. It's if you kind of get to halftime 0-0 or Sheffield United nick a first half lead that I'm going like, oh no, here we go.
Yeah, with Fulham, you just have to discard that, don't you? But I think Jack's right. I think it's clear that there are scars within the group. I think the Newcastle game was also this season, wasn't it? Where they scored 8. When that happens so many times, I think it can be very difficult to sort of flush that out the system. And that's why a fast start can really make the difference. What you don't want is something that suggests this is going to go a different way. And maybe can inspire some hope that otherwise wouldn't really exist. And I think the Bournemouth game was really quite telling, because it showed that there is some ability in that team. And Jack quite neatly summed up some of the key players there. And like Gustavo Hamer, who was excellent at Coventry. They have the ability to score goals, to play well in games, but they still threw that game away. You know, there are those vulnerabilities that I think Chris Wilder's even talked about this, and he's talked about wanting to play younger players, probably players who just can feel a bit freer from what has been quite a traumatic season. But I think from a Fulham perspective, you know, it's quite important that they win this game. Not just, you know, every game's important to win, but there's been a real consistency with performances. You know, obviously, results not as much of the defeat at Wolves comes to mind, but it's again a moment where if Fulham can win, and yes, they've played more games than some of the teams around them, they get closer to those European spots, and then suddenly you actually can say, well, maybe they are in the conversation.
Yeah.
Or at least could be in the conversation.
I think if you get 4 points out of Sheffield United and Forest, and definitely if you get 6, then I think Fulham are in the conversation. I think right now it looks quite close, but I think, like, clearly teams above us, you know, Chelsea have 2 games in hand, Newcastle, Wolves, Brighton all have a game in hand. For me, top 10 still the aim. And yeah, winning these 2 games, I think, will be crucial for Fulham getting there. In terms of lineup, I would be surprised if there's any real change from Spurs.
Wonder if Calvin Bassey is going to be fit and firing, considering he came back from international duty early with a little bit of a knock.
He was pictured in training looking all right yesterday. Yeah. Him, Kenny Tete, Willian and Harrison Reed were on some sort of winning team.
Great.
In training.
Fantastic.
And they all took a picture.
Well, there
they
we
all
go.
They all looked pretty happy.
100%
so
starting.
I'm hoping that, I mean, yeah, he might still have a knock. He might have been playing on crutches for all we know. But yeah, other than that, apart from, yeah, potentially an injury to Bassey, surely after a 3-0 win, it's as you were.
You don't change the team unless you have to. And I think that there's nothing to suggest, unless someone comes back from international duty absolutely shattered. We talked about, you know, before the break, the fact that the American players coming back a couple of days beforehand to allow that jet lag to shift. And sometimes you get them back on the Thursday night ahead of a Saturday. It felt like them coming back early after the CONCACAF Nations League was a big bonus, I think, for
from a Fulham perspective. So yeah, as long as there's no, you know, tiredness or injuries, I'd expect him to keep the same team. I don't see why there would be much change needed considering where Fulham were and, you know, what the last game looked like.
Just before we move on, by the way, it looks like if you're at the game on Saturday that the Sheffield United fans are, I don't know if it's 100% confirmed, but there's certainly been a lot of talk about
it. They're trying to do something anyway, even if it's not the full whack.
It's an applause on the 13th minute for Tim Ream for obviously being so amazing in that kind of Chris Basham moment. 13, obviously, Tim Ream's number.
I wonder if the club will do something. There was talk of that as well. I wonder if the actual, you know, there'll be something before the game or whatever, but... It did, you know, shout out to Sheffield United because they're in a tricky situation, obviously. They're not in a good place in the league. Fans are relatively unhappy with, I think, how things have gone. But still thinking about things like this, I thought it was a real touch of class.
Yeah. All right, we'll take a break there. Afterwards, we'll get in some of your questions. Part 3 of the Fulhamish podcast. Sammy here with Peter and Jack. Let's go through some of your questions before we finish today. No, this will catch on. I'll be honest, I had a really busy day. I wasn't able to get the clips ready. It'll be back. It'll be back in a couple of weeks.
It'll return.
I'm sorry. This one from Simon Goodall says, it's actually titled Question for Jack Collins. So Peter, clearly your input here is not welcome.
Talk to you later, guys. Cheers.
Yeah. I don't know why only Jack can answer this question. It's not, but anyway, I have a question for the podcast. Of the 7 goals scored by Rodrigo Muniz so far this season, which do you think is the best and why? Thanks from Simon, long-time listener, but first time asking a question.
Yay, love that. I'm not sure why I'm the only person that can answer that either. I thought it was going to be some really random question about like the niche qualifying stages of the Europa Conference League. I think it's the first one against Spurs.
Yeah.
Like, I think in real terms, obviously, you look back at the Burnley goal and think, great finish. But actually, I think watching it over and over again, Trafford should probably do a bit better. I think the confidence and the fluidity of that first finish against Spurs, where he takes it in stride, shifts and finishes it, I think that's my favourite. No, actually, I take that back. I think that's the best goal he scored. I think my favourite goal that he scored is the nip in and finish ahead of the goalkeeper against Bournemouth. The desire and heart of getting to that ball, just getting there and being ahead of the defender. And they are good centre-backs to be in front of them and be more aware and more alert to get past that. That's my favourite. But the best goal, I think, technically, is the one against Spurs, the first one.
Any disagreement, Peter? You are allowed to answer.
Yeah, I agree with Jack's logic around best goal. I wanted to include the Brighton game because he gave Adam Webster such a torrid time. And I really enjoyed his goal because it felt so much like 21-20-22, where, you know, Wilson cuts inside, crosses, Muniz is on the move, so terrific header into the net, and obviously he'd set up the first goal as well with some really superb forward play, just being a real pest. So probably go with Brighton, but that's probably not answering the question specifically, that's just saying which game I liked the most.
I think that's his best performance, for what it's worth.
I really liked the Villa goal. And I know it was a consolation, it was only 2-1, and it probably was slightly poor defending / goalkeeping, but actually the predatory instinct there.
Same thing, heart and soul as well to get to it.
And just a goal out completely nuts. And that game was dying. We were dead in that game. And like, we very nearly got a point. And that would have all been down to Rodrigo Muniz. Obviously now, yeah, we didn't get the point, so it doesn't really matter. But I that was one that I particularly liked. This one from Bruce Robertson.
Who's it for?
Well, he doesn't specifically say, but I'm going to go to Peter on this one because I kind of got your opinion on this last week, but it'd be particularly interesting to hear Peter's insight from kind of his contacts around the club. Bruce says, hello, have been in Cape Town for the last 7 weeks and have been avidly listening to the show. Was wondering what your opinion is of Boa leaving the fold. How much was his contribution to the Marco Silva miracle and like a great double act? Morecambe and Wise, Clough and Taylor, Lennon McCartney, they are not as good on their own. Loving the show, all the best from Bruce. So we actually asked this question last week, Peter. What significance to the team, if any, will Boa leaving be? Is he the genius behind the whole thing, or actually, you know, is it, you know, sad to see him go, of course, but Marco and his team will no doubt find a replacement and probably pick things up where they left off roughly.
Yeah, no, I listened to the conversation last week and I think you guys, touched on it quite well in the end. I think
started off the shambles, but we got there.
Took you 5 minutes, but yeah, you
I was a bit shaky at first, but no, it's fine. It's an interesting question. I think Louis Bamorte and Marco Silva go back a long time. I think I wrote about this. I think it was the Sunderland game where Silva had a touchline ban and then was up in the analyst post, and he was sat next to Antonis Lemonakis, his analyst. And I would say that Lemonakis, and I've written this a few times, is probably... Silva never talks about one being more than the other, but I think he's incredibly important to what Fulham do and to what Marco Silva does. And I remember just around that game talking about, you know, obviously Luis Bamorte and Marco Silva go back a really long time. They met when they were teenagers. Cova de Piedade, I've probably butchered that pronunciation, Jack. Apologies. Growing up in Lisbon. They'd stayed in touch, worked together. Luis Bamorte, I think, trained with while Marco Silva was coaching for a while. Certainly was with him while learning to coach, learning his badges. And then, you know, obviously they only came together at Everton after João Pedro Sousa left. And João Pedro Sousa had been with Silva for a bit longer. He's now manager of Famalicão. So I think Luis Bamorte's role was important. I think he's important around the squad. He's a really key part of Marco Silva's team. It's a close-knit team that have been together for some time, but I think that's a position that's been replaced before by Silva, and I think it will be again in the summer. You've got Stuart Gray, who's also got a sort of an assistant to the manager role in that setup. There's Goncalo Pedro, who's more of the fitness coach. Bruno Mendes, head of performance, and Hugo Oliveira as well, obviously goalkeeper coach. Obviously to lose an assistant is important. I would say Lemonakis is really key of them. And I think maybe I'd be slightly more concerned if Lemonakis had gone for whatever reason, hypothetically.
Yeah.
But you know, Luis Bamorte, I think it's been known that he's wanted to have his own managerial career, right? So that's always in mind, and it is often the case with an assistant. And that's actually what João Pedro Sousa did before under Silva, and now Luis Bamorte is going to do the same.
Okay. All right. Also thank you to John Brooker, who emailed in and basically asked exactly the same question as Bruce. So I'll consider both of those ticked off in the old inbox. I like this one from Matt Roberts, who says, "Hello, Sammy, Jack, and everyone at Fulhamish. I've been thinking about how this season compares to last season, and I think I'm coming down on the side of this one being better due to the incredible peaks of two penalty shootout victories, a cup run that ended in pride rather than disgrace, wins over Arsenal, Tottenham and Man United, seeing Muniz flourish, and that feeling that Craven Cottage is a fortress. But there are a couple of milestones from last season that really stand out to me, and I've picked up some questions related to those." He says, "Last year, we picked up a Premier League record 7 away wins. This seems to be the biggest difference between the two seasons. This year, we're only on 2 wins. Obviously, to match that record, we'd have to win all our remaining 5 away games, which seems unlikely, although a lot of those games are against sides in the bottom 6. Do you think our much poorer away record this season is mostly because we've got so many of these easier games to come, and by the end of the season, it will look more similar to last year's record?" He then says, "Last year, we scored a Premier League record 55 goals. We're currently on 43, so with 9 games to go, this record is very much within reach. I think it would be pretty staggering if we're able to match or better last year's total, when so much of the narrative until December was, quite rightly, about our lack of potency in front of goal. Can you comment about how our attacking play has evolved without Mitrovic?" All right, we'll go with question one first about the away game record. I think maybe it's a mixture of, I think we have been poorer on the road this season, Jack, but also I do think that the disparity between the two seasons will probably level out. I don't think we're going to get 7, though.
No, I think we might end up on sort of 4 or 5.
Yeah, which is okay.
Which is fine.
The fixtures were terrible, weren't they, in the first half of the season?
Yeah, I'd kind of double down on that. They'd be like, once you get a couple under your belt, you feel a little bit more confident. I know that sounds a bit ridiculous because we won our first away game of the season, but it was a non-confident performance with Mitrovic still part of the squad at that point as well. All a bit weird. And
I think then from that moment, it was like, okay, Fulham, every time we went on the road, we felt shaky. Whereas in the last couple of performances, in the last couple of weeks, I think it's been like, oh, okay, we go away and we look comfortable. That doesn't mean we win every time, but we look like we're in games.
Yeah.
And I think last year it felt more like we got off to that start. And once that happened, it was like, well, Fulham can win away from home. And as soon as that feels possible, you start to have a bit of a, you know, a go at it. I also think there was probably an element that I think there were probably worse teams. This is maybe a controversial one. I think the bottom of the Premier League was weaker last season than it is this year. Like, I think there was a bigger spectrum of weaker sides.
Okay, I see.
So I think there was the very bottom is obviously worse than it was last year. No doubt about that whatsoever. But I think that there were sort of 7-8 teams, you know, who finished below us who you're like, well, yeah, we could beat any of those. And this year, I think that feels a bit more that, you know, the teams that are down there, it feels a bit more like you're like, oh, okay, where are we at? And I'm not sure 100% that we'd go away and beat a Brentford, for example, in a way that I was pretty comfortable with us going and beating like a Southampton last year. I know they got relegated and Brentford probably won't be. You take my point.
Mm. I think you can't judge though, Peter, this season's away record, considering especially that those wins away from home last season were all against bottom sides. Famously, that was what Fulham did last year. We didn't beat sides in the top 10, but we did beat all of the sides basically that got relegated and were in amongst that kind of relegation battle. So I think it's only at the end of the season you're going to be able to truly compare whether we actually have been that bad away from home.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. I think that's fair. I think, you know, the start of the season was also very slow. The adjustment to Mitrovic, and that's the other part of the question, isn't it? You know, how the attacks evolved. That's taken time. It's taken a long time. We've talked about it previously in podcasts. I think it's dated back to the back end of last season where Mitrovic was suspended and how Fulham found that very difficult, and Raul Jimenez has been a different striker and different type of striker, and I think just as they were sort of adapt to how he was playing, and that's when form kicked on and results were improving, including away from home. Rodrigo Muniz now finds form and he's a bit more similar, I would say. So we've almost kind of not reverted back but gone back to a similar direction. But yeah, the end of the season will give a clearer picture. It's interesting because we, on The Athletic, we're grading every team's season so far.
Fulham got an A-, I saw.
I gave them an A-. I was between that and a B+. But it, I know we talked about Europe earlier in the podcast, but, you know, as the question outlines, to match some of those achievements last season, considering how the summer went, of course, I think the squad is stronger this year. There's better depth in the squad this year, in my opinion. But considering the striker issues and losing Mitrovic, not replacing him, to then potentially get close to or match or better what Fulham did last year is pretty impressive, isn't it? That's a real feather in Marco Silva's cap.
Did you have any more to add on how Fulham have changed their attacking style without Mitrovic?
I mean, we've diversified, right? And it's not taken it's not been easy. And it took a while, and it feeds back into all these parts of the question feed back into each other. Why were Fulham lacking that potency in the first, you know, half of the season? Well, because we didn't know how to use any of our strikers. And we were whacking Mitrovic-esque balls into the middle of the box and hoping Raul Jimenez got on the end of them, which was never going to happen. It was only once Fulham started to diversify that portfolio of how we were kind of working with, if you get what I mean, and start to understand that, okay, not everything now has to be a dinked up back post header for our striker to attack, that things started to click. And I think that period with Raul has really helped with this explosion of Muniz. Maybe this is, you know, to taking the question to a, you know, a different level, but I think without that period where Fulham learned to try to play to Raul's strengths, we would have struggled far more to deal with it. If Muniz had been thrown in at that exact moment, would he have had the success with the team around him that he is having right now? I don't think so.
Are you saying Raul walked
so that Muniz could run? Yeah. I'm saying the Mexican doormat, as we're going to call him from now on, allowed the Brazilian god to walk through the door comfortably. But I do think that it's important that Fulham learns to not isolate. And we talked about it as well last year. How much do we discuss the idea that it's not just Fulham, Mitrovic scoring goals for Fulham, it's that the attack is hardwired around the way that he plays. Then that's why we struggled at the back end of last season, because when he wasn't there, there was no one to do the kind of link-up job that he was doing. Fulham have learned to bypass that with Muniz, and you know, Dan and I spoke on the whiteboard at length about how it's a different type of style with Muniz there, and we're expecting other players to do different things, players being asked to do more in various areas in order to kind of grow into that. All of that, I think, comes about because Fulham had to come away from having a singular plan A style of attack that worked the strengths of Alexander Mitrovic. And that ability to change things up, to you look at how much the two wingbacks bombed on in the Tottenham game, moving forward and getting past, and at times on paper, leaving ourselves incredibly exposed to allow ourselves to overload in these areas. That's all part of a strategy. And I think that what we're seeing with this Fulham team is that they're starting to learn how to score goals in a lot of different ways. And that's really important.
Yeah. All right. Well, we'll leave it there for today. Thank you ever so much for listening. Thank you for all your emails. I've still got so many. We're nearly going to devote almost a show.
We should have done an email show in the international break.
Yeah, I know. We should have. Should have, would have, could have. Peter, thank you for coming on today.
No problem at all, Sammy. Thank you for having me.
And Jack, thank you.
No, it's always a pleasure, Sammy. Good to be back.
We will be back Sunday evening, Monday morning-ish, looking back at the Sheffield United game and everything that happens in that match. We'll also be doing a quick take near Bramall Lane with all of our instant reaction to the match. So head to the YouTube channel on Saturday evening to watch that. And that's it for the podcast today. Have a lovely Easter weekend, whatever you're doing. If you're heading up to Sheffield, safe travels. I think there should be a good allocation of people that's heading up to South Yorkshire. And fingers crossed, we can get a win. I'll take 1-0. I don't want a 5 or a 6. Just give me one. That'll be fine. That'll be lovely. If you're heading up, have a great weekend. If not, have a lovely Easter. And we'll see you next week. Come on, you whites.
You whites.